Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Oh, yes, I was going
to. Yes, you're starting.
So, would
you like to start again? Should I clap again?
No. One clap will be plenty. Save the clapping for the end. Hold all applause. Well, we saw a movie not long ago. Called Personal Shopper by Olivier Assayas. And whenever someone was telling me that he had a new film coming out, this was last year, you know, maybe a year ago, there's a new film by Olivier Assayas starring Kristen Stewart. And it's about, and I, at that point, would just say, stop. That's enough right there. I mean, I'm interested. I've liked almost all of his movies. There are a couple of, a few I haven't seen, but I like this guy, and he's made, you know, movies like Summer Hours and Clouds of Sils Maria, and something about the way he puts stories together is really mysterious. He has a way of exploring internal ideas that are in people's heads, but doing it in a very cinematic way. And I think that Personal Shopper is a really good example of that. It's, I expected it to be a very, I don't know why, I didn't know a lot about it, like I said, but I expected it to be just a very naturalistic kind of extension of a character that Kristen Stewart played in the previous film that he made, where she was starring with Juliette Binoche. This time she's playing a personal shopper for a famous
socialite.
Socialite, yeah. I guess you could say. I wasn't totally clear what entirely she's famous for, but she's definitely a celebrity of sorts, and she's the personal shopper for this woman. But it begins in sort of a different place altogether in her life. She's entering an old house. She's going to spend the night there. The way it all unfolds is a little bit mysterious, but after a few minutes into the movie, I was a little bit creeped out because it gets very eerie very quickly as we suddenly realize, I suddenly realized, this is a ghost story.
Yep.
And there's a ghost here. And it doesn't take long before we realize that it's not just the idea of a ghost, but it is a literal, I mean, it's a piece of the movie that there is a ghost, a presence in this place that she's investigating as a medium. And one of the things I love about his movies and this movie is the way things unfold.
Yes.
And so I'm sure we probably will describe the plot and who the people are. But part of the fun is figuring this out because she's driven to this house by a woman who gives her a hug and says, all right, you're going to spend the night? No, I'm not going to spend the night. Just I'll leave it to you. It's too much for me. But and, you know, what's going on here? I don't know the relationship between these two women. Why is she spending the night? Who is the ghost? Well, it turns out Kristen Stewart plays a woman named Maureen. Her twin brother has passed away. He was partnered with this other woman who had just dropped off Maureen to stay in what was their house, it seems, an old French house with big, giant creaking doors. And part of the fun of this opening sequence is the way she sort of walks from dark room to dark room and, clunks these doors closed. Yeah. And they seem very secure, but also there's all kinds of wind and thumps in the night, and it gets pretty creepy.
Yes, it does.
But this is one aspect of the movie. It's kind of a central aspect, the way that she is investigating perhaps the presence of her dead brother here.
And she, as we learn later, she wants to sort of, you know, it's not that she's just sort of intrigued, but she has this real need to encounter him as a ghost. That's not immediately clear exactly what she's doing, but we learn later that she really does want to have an encounter with him.
Yeah, and that it's something that they actually agreed to do when he was still alive. They've both apparently called themselves mediums all along, and both felt some connection to a spirit world, and both agreed that whoever was the first to go would try to reach out to the other. And so she seems to want to know if he's at peace, and so this is a very literal ghost story that the movie's telling, but it's also just a sort of reflection of her grieving process that is sort of made manifest in a way. And one of the things I love about his movies, and we can talk more about here, is the way often the central themes get reflected in almost everywhere you look. You know, you see the other relationships that are in the movie, you see the other things that happen in the movie, and they just expand on this idea of the lost person, a person trying to create connections to other people, to the past, to people who are gone, and grieving. And so a compact movie at maybe an hour and a half, and it feels swift. But at the same time, when I start thinking about it, it just feels like it's packed, just packed. Mm. And I really like that.
Yeah, I agree. I found that theme of being a medium or a stand-in particularly powerful, you know, because in a way, everything about Kristen Stewart's character, about Maureen, is that she's standing in. So her job as a personal shopper is to try on these various clothes that the socialite might wear at a fashion show or at, you know, some big event. And so in a way, Kristen Stewart is a stand-in or a medium for this woman and the clothes that she'll wear. She's, of course, also, you know, a medium in sort of the old-fashioned sense of trying to encounter the dead. And there's various references to that, and we actually even, like, see an old movie of mediums trying to do that very thing. But then there's another point, like, where she's at this photo shoot, and her boss is supposed to be there for the shoot, but the boss or the woman is late, and so the photographer asks, you know, Kristen Stewart if she'll stand in so that they can get the lighting and everything right for this. And so it's just interesting how, in a variety of ways, that's what Kristen Stewart's role is to be this medium or stand-in for a variety of people. And it's interesting to think what that would be like in a variety of settings, because we all are like that in certain ways, I think, is that we stand in for other people or other people stand in for us. And I found that a compelling theme throughout the film.
Yeah. And as she's shopping for these items for this woman, you know, she's going to these very, she's not shopping at the Gap or Macy's or something. No, that's right. She's going to these very high end, you know, very custom made things that, you know, there's only one or two of these leather pants. They only come in these two, and then we're going to cut them to fit your client specifically. And she can wear them to this event and then needs to bring them back or something like that. You know, it's a very specific situation. But as she goes around looking at these things, she grips them, you know, she picks, she doesn't just look at, well, let's see, what belt should I use? She picks it up and she squeezes it. And you can hear the leathers on the soundtrack. You know, she almost never speaks directly to her boss. It's over phones. It's over messages. It's over notes that are left on tables. And so it's like this ghostly presence that she's dressing all of the time. And maybe something about grasping this stuff is making it more real, more physical. I don't know. It's just a neat contrast there, and that happens a lot.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting, too, to think of the movie itself as a kind of medium for Asayas. You know, the sense of a stand-in for him, that, you know, we don't really see him, of course, but yet his movies are almost a way of his communicating with an audience, you know, via actors and actresses and via the medium of film. It's sort of interesting to think about that theme in a more meta sense. I found that very provocative too.
Yeah, the camera is a really, there are times when the camera very self-consciously makes a movement that I feel isn't just some sort of objective way of capturing what's going on. It's like, no. This camera is a point of view. Who is this camera?
right. And sometimes that's supposed to be us, like in that opening sequence where Maureen is walking through this old house, and it is genuinely creepy in a wonderful way. You know, we see certain things and don't see other things, and that, you know, adds to the suspense, it adds to the fear. But you're right, though, there's other times where it's like, wait, where are we? You know, exactly what's going on that we are seeing this from this perspective. And it sort of heightens our sense of that we're watching a movie. But it also, I think, creates a kind of a, an interesting sense of dislocation at times, I found.
Yeah. And there are times, at some point here in this discussion, we're going to have to talk about the very end. Because the very end is especially provocative, I think. But it's one of two points where the camera is, I feel like, one of maybe more than two, but two that I can think of, where it's an actual, maybe one of the characters in the in the story. There's a moment where she is in her boss's apartment, and she's trying on some of these things that she's bought for her. And
which she's not supposed to do at this point.
No, she's not. Well, even when she's kind of shopping and the designers are like, would you like to try this? Often she's very hesitant to do that, as if she's been admonished for that in the past. You know?
Yep.
Like, no, I'm not going to. But she will. She'll slip on a pair of boots and walk and become a different person for a moment. Mm-hmm. You know, the look on her face, the way she walks and moves is so very different. And she sort of is lost in thought for a moment. But she pursues this further, and we'll talk about why, I think, in a minute. But she enters the woman's house when she knows she's gone. You can actually look up, you know, paparazzi photos of her in Milan, so you know where she is. She's not here in Paris. She's gone. And so Maureen is in her house. She slips on these clothes. She shops for them in the closet. You know, she's
looks around.
She's like gripping things, like, you know, feeling their essence or something. She disrobes and redresses as this woman in a way. And mm-hmm. and then she lies down in her bed and is about to have a private moment. And the camera backs away in a very stylized kind of dissolve. And yep. I got the feeling that I suddenly realized how, in a way, voyeuristic the camera was being as we watched mm-hmm. her dress. Mm-hmm. And then how we suddenly crossed a line where even the camera, whoever, whatever that is uncomfortable mm-hmm. with this moment and wants to step away. And yep. we see no more. But it's like, it was the first time where I was very conscious of that perhaps we're the ghost or a ghost, as you said, that it's, in a way, it's a metaphor for cinema or for the mm-hmm. director, who's sort mm-hmm. of always the ghost in a film, but very explicitly here.
Yeah, no, that's nice. It's also, I think, worth just mentioning, you've talked a little bit about the sound. Yeah, the sound design is I thought, particularly striking in the movie. You notice it right away when they're this opening scene in this old house, because, yeah, the doors are clunking and you hear a window kind of slam shut and you hear the sound or the wind. But the sound design is so stark at times. I was actually reading an interview with Assayas, and he talks about sort of being influenced by Bresson. And that was the exact reference I was thinking of during the movie, is this sort of really stark sound design that draws attention to itself, but not in a way that's, I don't know, it feels natural, and yet you can't help but notice it. And I found that very compelling, particularly, of course, in the last scene that we'll talk about here at some point.
It's funny, I hadn't made that connection, but when you say Bresson, I suddenly think of A Man Escaped, and my mm-hmm. my main image of that is like the crunch of glass,
yeah.
which is a sound. It's not a visual, really.
Right.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, the sounds are very eerie. There are times when she's in that house, for example, when it's creepy like a scary movie is, but mm-hmm. I'm trying to pinpoint sometimes why am I suddenly sensing that there's something here? It's partly that she's sensing it. And really mm-hmm. the scariest thing that she says in the movie, I think she says it twice, is, "I don't know you."
Mm.
Where she's communicating with the thing that's bumping or moving around or making itself known in this dark room, and she suddenly realizes, "I am talking to someone, but it's not my brother," and that's
right.
really creepy and weird. And
yeah.
but anyway, the sound design is definitely a part of this, like how we mm-hmm. know that there's something there, but it's very subtle,
yeah,
very careful.
Yes, it's strange to think that something can be both subtle and obvious, and yet I think the movie pulls it off really beautifully.
Yeah, I think partly by being so. By letting us figure things out gradually. I remember that the first of his movies that I saw was Irma Vep with Maggie Cheung. Did you see that?
I have not seen that. No. Nope.
Years and years ago. It's such a strange movie, because it's kind of in these, I think of it as these segments where a lot of it is about the making of a movie. Someone is deciding to remake this old, there were these French serials by Fouillade called Les Vampires, about these women who were cat burglars. So they dressed in these kind of leotards and would sneak into places. These are silent serials, but someone in the, I guess this is the 90s, is remaking them with Maggie Cheung and Jean-Pierre Léaud, this icon of the French New Wave. But so there's a lot of this sort of behind the scenes making of kind of stuff. And then there are scenes of Maggie Cheung in this kind of leather outfit as a cat burglar. But then there are these scenes where she actually seems to be a cat burglar. Like we see her slinking around this hotel and like taking things. And you wonder, are we in the movie? Are we in a dream? Are we where are we? And it's not ever clear, because it doesn't work on that level where you piece things out. It works on the level of images, of the idea of Maggie Cheung walking around in a hotel, is just an idea that the movie will explore. And where it fits into the story is not at all clear. And I sort of get that from Personal Shopper also, where part of what's unsettling about it is these mysteries that I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of, but the way they're woven together is part of how the effect is built, I think.
It's interesting. I've watched this movie twice. I saw it, I think, a little more than a year ago, or maybe exactly a year ago. And then when I knew we were going to podcast, watched it maybe a month or two ago. And the one thing that was quite different for me on the second viewing was in the second half of the film, there's this kind of narrative trope where Maureen starts getting mysterious text messages. And we're supposed to wonder whether it's actually, you know, somehow a ghost communicating with her or someone stalking her. But it feels sort of supernatural but definitely ominous. And it was interesting how different that was on the second viewing, because once I knew what it was or what it wasn't, it had a lot less interest for me. I found it actually kind of irritating the second time around, because okay, I know what this is. We don't have to go anywhere. When I noticed that on the second viewing, I realized that that's the only part of the movie that's true for me. The rest of the movie, even though, yes, I know what's going on, it still has just as much mystery and just as much sort of creepy interest as it did the first time I watched it. It was only that sort of set of text messages that didn't work for me the second time around.
Huh. So it was, the mystery was robbed a bit. So
yeah. Yeah. But just for that, you know, the opening sequence and then the closing scene, those work just as well, if not better, the second time around. I actually liked the movie more the second time than I did even the first time.
I like the text messages too. Even I've seen it twice too. And I feel like part of what I like about it is, I think of the word playful, although that isn't really the mood of the movie. The movie isn't playful, but the way it combines things into its theme is interesting. And in this case, yes, someone is texting her and seems to be right nearby, like mm-hmm. can see her, knows where she's going. Oh, no, he says he's just kidding. He isn't really nearby, but he does know where she's going and seems to know things about her. And she kind of looks around her like, is it someone right next to me on this train? Is it someone who watched me get on this? And yet it may not be, but the fact that whether it's a person or not, it manifests as a ghostly kind mm-hmm. of presence, even mm-hmm. if it is just a person who's toying with her, you know. And we do get the answer later for what is actually happening. But the way the ghostliness is sort of recreated here via text message is neat. And the way mm-hmm. I thought a lot about how the movie has almost no physical interactions at all, like in the entire film. I think there maybe is a hug at the beginning, but almost everything else is mediated by many layers of technology or phones or a note left, almost everything.
The one sort of clear counterexample to that is when she goes to the house of the woman who used to be her brother's partner, lover, fiance.
Yeah.
And she meets that woman's new boyfriend. And they sort of talk in the backyard of the house. And that is sort of, to me, the one sort of counterexample to that is a moment of sort of real connection. Not that they like sort of learn a lot about each other, but that they're having a conversation that's not mediated. And I actually really like that scene for that reason.
I did too. I almost feel like he's putting something sort of realistic mm-hmm. on the whole thing. He's talking to her about how he knows she's probably uncomfortable and about his being there. And she's like, well, why? And he says, well, you know, I've taken your brother's place in a way. Mm-hmm. And he says he knows that her brother was a medium. And he says this mm-hmm. almost with air quotes, you know, like he doesn't mm-hmm. fully believe this. But then he describes her brother as just someone who he felt was deeply intuitive mm-hmm. and seemed to understand things that were unspoken, which is a very real and concrete way that people can be intuitive in the real world yep. and interact with people. And it isn't supernatural in that way, mm-hmm. you know, but it was his interpretation of sort of the other mm-hmm. things we've been seeing, which I did think was neat.
It's interesting too, to sort of talk about this final scene is, this will sound strange, but even the second time it caught me by surprise, because it feels like the movie has ended. And so to sort of almost celebrate Maureen surviving this whole experience, she's going to go join up with her her boyfriend in, is it Oman?
Yeah.
Somewhere, yeah, in Oman. And for a few minutes, we have this spectacularly beautiful travelogue, which actually reminds me of certain parts of Cloud of Sils Maria, which is set in the mountains and is very beautiful at times. And so it's like, oh, this is going to be kind of a nice, pleasant way to end the movie. But no, she's going to have one last ghost encounter. And I don't know if it's the creepiest of the bunch, but it's sort of intriguing because it doesn't take place in a dark house. It takes place in this sort of, fairly brightly lit room in a beautiful part of this, a tourist place where she's going. And I just found that a really interesting transition, but very effective for me.
Yeah. So. Well, and she has made such a big deal about why she was staying in Paris. Like mm-hmm. her, I guess it's a boyfriend, but he's a very distant kind of boyfriend. He's been in Oman this whole time and they've had a few chats on FaceTime, but mostly he's like, why are you still in Paris? And she's like, I told you, I need to stay here. I'm trying to, contact my brother, as if it really matters where she is, that she needs to be in that house. And now suddenly she's away from that. And like you say, we sort of assume this is an epilogue and she's moving on. She's finally sort of closed that chapter, but she hasn't. And it really isn't about the place at which the sort of final question of the movie. And what I love about the last, maybe, what is it? 3 seconds of the movie, she's questioning this thing that is communicating with her by thumps, which are very ambiguous.
But very ominous.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the thumps have a, it's hard to describe the sound they make, but it's not a normal thump, I'll just say that.
It's heavy, and you almost feel the rubble of the mm-hmm. Sand falling from the walls every time it happens, mm-hmm. pile driver kind of thing. And she's asking things like, do you mean harm? And it seems to answer yes, and she says that phrase again, I don't know you, mm-hmm. And that's very creepy, even in this mm-hmm. daylight. And then I love the final question.
Yeah, is it you or is it just me?
Yeah. Yeah. And there is a response, and the response is such a jolt to her that she breaks the fourth wall and looks into the mm-hmm. camera mm-hmm. and the movie fades to white and it's the end.
Yeah. 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 It's a spectacular ending. There's no doubt about it. It's, I was so surprised that even on the second viewing, it caught me by surprise. Like, oh yeah, that's right. It's this scene. But I didn't, for some reason, see it coming, and I enjoyed it just as much the second time as I did the first. But yeah, it's such a great way to end the movie.
And it isn't that she hasn't been skeptical in the past. She seems like someone who's felt like she's been in touch with a spirit world, but doesn't know what to make of that. She doesn't have any explanation, doesn't have any sort of framework for how it's supposed to work. She just knows that she does. And she's also been skeptical about whether she's talking to her brother. She's been a bit introspective when she's sort of having this text chat with this person about why do you like to wear this woman's clothes when she's not around? Is it something about it being forbidden? Is it that she gets to slip into someone else's identity? There's a little bit of introspection there. But I think we don't get the full kind of, is this whole thing about my grieving until maybe those last few seconds. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I find it really powerful, even in it, as simple as it is. It's mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to explain why. I was thinking a little bit about the way movies can lie to you about what's real and what isn't real, It's another way of saying they're subjective. Mm-hmm. I remember, there's this moment in Vertigo when Scotty's had this trauma that Madeline, the woman he was in love with, he died before his eyes, fell off of the San Juan Bautista tower. And he's wandering San Francisco in this haze of grief. And he's at the restaurant they used to go to, and he sees a woman off in the corner who it looks an awful lot like her. Mm. And in a couple of shots, Hitchcock uses Kim Novak, the woman who played Madeline, as that woman in the corner. The movie lies to mm-hmm. us to mm-hmm. in order to get us into his head, because then when she walks forward, it actually isn't her.
Right.
And it's an interesting lie, because in this movie, she didn't die and she is alive and she is walking around in San Francisco somewhere. It just isn't right here right now. But I like that, he used the wrong actor there, because we need to see it from Scotty's perspective.
Yeah.
And I thought of this other one, this other example, The Conversation. Francis Coppola's movie, little but great movie that he made in between The Godfathers. Mm. It's Gene Hackman is a surveillance guy, and he's picked up a recording. He was hired to just record this couple's conversation, and what he hears is alarming. And they say, the words are, he'd kill us if he had the chance. But the way he hears it is with inflection on certain words. And if you hear, he'd kill us if he had the chance. That means something different from he'd kill us if he had the chance, you know? and I assume that if that what he actually hears is vague and neutral enough that he can interpret it how he wants. But the way Coppola plays it to us in the first part of the movie and then again at the end of the movie is different, so that he lies to us about what it sounds like so that we get to follow along with Gene Hackman's, you know, perspective on this. And I know I've talked on this podcast before about how I don't like puzzle movies or movies that are all about just figuring out the thing you're supposed to figure out. Is this real or is it not? Mm-hmm. You know, The Sixth Sense or Fight Club or something. But I found that as I was thinking about Personal Shopper and about that ending, that I think the thing I don't like about that kind of movie is the movie expending a lot of energy on that. Like, I don't mind if it's a jumbled mystery that's never solved. And I also don't mind if, as in Personal Shopper, I think there's a little hint in that last 3 seconds that just think of the idea that this is mostly about her grieving and about her relationship to her brother, how he's gone, and about the absence of people in her life. And whether or not the ghost is real or it is irrelevant, and the movie's going to spend no time on that, and it's going to go to credits in 2 seconds. But think about that on your way out, you know? I like that. I like that a lot.
Louis, is it you? Louis, is it you? Or is it just me?
Asayas's earlier film, Clouds of Sils Maria, the movie's pretty much just a two-hander. It's Kristen Stewart, Juliette Binoche. Juliette Binoche is a famous actress trying to prepare for a role on stage. Kristen Stewart is her personal assistant, who for much of the film is like helping her process, you know, going back on doing this play. And so like they're at times they're running lines, at times they're just sort of talking about it. But towards the end of the movie, there's this sort of long sequence where they are running through lines. But you sort of realize that the line or the characters in the play certainly have some overlap with Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart's characters in the movie. And they're kind of irritated with each other. And so they go on this walk and then they kind of get lost. And then Kristen Stewart's character disappears. I mean, just completely disappears. in a sort of an odd way. And you kind of go, wait, what just happened? Yeah. And not to spoil things, but she never appears. I mean, that's it. Yeah. I mean, it's and Juliette Binoche doesn't seem to, and she reacts sort of, but it's almost like the movie just says, okay, Kristen Stewart's not in this movie anymore. But it's sort of intriguing to me. It's one of the things I actually really like about that film, because it's like, what is going on here? But in kind of a fun way. It's a puzzle movie that it doesn't, like you say, it doesn't spend much time. It doesn't spend any time.
No.
and yet I think the absence of the character makes a difference. And we're supposed to sort of think about, how does this make a difference? What does it mean that Juliette Binoche is now doing this play without Kristen Stewart around? Or what does it mean for the movie that this, you know, pretty central character just suddenly vanishes? And I found that it's one of my favorite things about Clouds of Sils Maria.
Yeah, who was she? Yeah, and you start thinking, she was in some ways a reflection of Juliette Binoche when she was younger, you know, which is a lot of her preoccupation with going back to this play when she was in this play when she was very young, and now she's playing a different character, and she's in a different place in her own life, and her assistant, Kristen Stewart, is much younger, and I'm sure she sees herself in that a lot. And then when it's suddenly gone, it is strange. It's a La Ventura, you know, Antonioni-esque kind of a disappearance.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, they were great together in that movie, too. I mean, I never had any reason to doubt that Kristen Stewart was a good actor, but I think these two films, you know, back to back, are certainly strong evidence that she's really good, and at the very least at choosing good movies. Mm. But also, she's in, you know, toe-to-toe with Juliette Binoche.
No, that's
Clouds
right.
Of Sils Maria.
Yeah. And what's interesting for me, I've talked about this before, so it feels a little bit like I'm just being repetitive here, but I was intrigued by my different reaction to both movies when I watched them a second time, because the first time I saw them both, I liked Clouds of Sils Maria better. I think in part just because I really love Juliette Binoche, and I really love sort of this role she plays in that movie. But when I watched it a second time, in part because I knew we were going to talk about Personal Shopper, I was more interested in the Kristen Stewart character. And as great as Kristen Stewart is in the first movie, she's better in Personal Shopper, and it's a more interesting sort of character. And so I liked Personal Shopper better the second time, I think in part just because I was watching for that. Whereas in Clouds of Sils Maria the second time, I wasn't as focused on Juliette Binoche as I was the first time.
Yeah. You almost get the feeling that it's like, let's do another movie with this one.
Yeah.
No, let's focus on her.
Yeah, because I mean it's not that different of a role. The way it works out is quite different, but it's, you know, it's still this idea of almost being a personal assistant and someone whose personality is or at least most of her life is wrapped up in sort of working for this other person. But what does it mean then to actually focus on that kind of character? That I thought was really a brilliant move in Personal Shopper.
Yeah, and what she does with the characters, I think, is quite different. Like, she's she speaks in a really kind of halting way in Personal Shopper, and she's more of a fast talker in Clouds of Sils Maria. I think if you saw the two characters speak for a minute, you'd be able to pick them apart, you know, even if they were both Kristen Stewart dressed the same or whatever, even though their sort of jobs are similar. But yeah, they're very different.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that they were running lines, you know, as Juliette Binoche is practicing for the play she's going to be in, and she's and Kristen Stewart's character. I've forgotten their names, but their characters are, you know, they're working on lines. But very often you enter the conversation and it isn't clear. Like you said, there is a reflection of them in the material. And so often when he just jumps in, Esaias just jumps into a scene, you don't know. Are they talking to each other? Are they a little irritated? What's going on here? And then it's like, oh, I see, they're reading from a script.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're not.
Maybe they're
adding a little bit here. The line is very blurry.
Yes.
And increasingly so.
Yeah. Yeah, which is wonderful.
Oh, you know, another thing I like about Personal Shopper is I mentioned how everything the communication seems so mediated, but I was especially taken by this She's heard about various... When she hears about an artist who claims to have spoken or communicated with the dead and was influenced by that, or when she hears of Rudolf Steiner who was into that, she goes to explore that. You know, she goes to get a book, or she pulls up a documentary. And she's watching this documentary on... I think it was the one on Rudolf Steiner, and she's... No, it was the painter. So I was thinking about how many layers there were here. She's like, she's curious about this painter who's from the early 1900s, who painted things that were abstract before there was abstract art, and they weren't discovered until 20 years after her death. And so now she's kind of, she's become an interesting figure for that reason. But as Kristen Stewart is watching a documentary on her phone while traveling through a train and walking down escalators of a woman who painted 100 years ago and communicated with people who weren't there and left her paintings for to be discovered after she died. I don't know the layers here. It's not simply mediation, but it's like the distance that she's trying to bridge is vast and yet intimate at the same time. It's on this tiny little screen.
Yep.
And I felt that sort of throughout the movie when she was texting with the person. There were times when she's getting on trains and planes and she has to momentarily put her stuff on the security conveyor belt and put her phone here. I was worried for a second she's going to lose contact with this guy when she is suddenly out of reach of her phone, you know?
But you know what I found particularly interesting about the way phones and laptops work in this movie is especially when Kristen Stewart is looking at something like watching, some YouTube clip or watching the movie you were talking about. Asayas shoots this as if the phone is like floating. It's a screen that's like floating in air almost, and it creates this almost ghostly image that we're watching something disembodied. I loved that. I just thought that was really cool. I never got tired of that.
Oh yeah. That actually reminds me of one of the documentaries she's watching is on her laptop, and she's in the middle of seeing this discussion about the trying to reach the dead. And all of a sudden there's this boom, 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 boom. And her boyfriend's face literally appears on the screen and he's like, "Hey, what's up?" You know, it's such a wow that speaking of disembodied heads there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's such a great movie in that there are so many layers in the film and there's so many different ways of appreciating it. And it's absolutely worth seeing. Rob, I remember you telling me you saw Darren Aronofsky's Mother last year in the fall, and
his movie.
That's right, not his mother, but yes, the movie called Mother, which doesn't have a capital letter and has an exclamation point in the title. I actually like Aronofsky's stuff, or at least I found it intriguing, but for some reason I wasn't particularly interested in this one. The reviews were okay, but mixed. And I said, well, maybe I'll see that. Maybe I won't. But a couple of times when we had dinner in the fall, you sort of brought up what a weird movie this was and how it'd be worth at least talking a little bit about it. And so I finally had a chance to see it last month. And you're right. That is a weird movie, but worth talking about. And so, you know, it reminded me a little bit of a Michael Haneke film because it's about this couple who's in this big old house by themselves, and then suddenly people start showing up. The husband, played by Javier Bardem, is a famous poet, if there can be such a thing, but he is a famous poet. And his much younger wife, which to the movie's credit, they don't sort of gloss over, but they actually sort of deal with it as a real theme, is played by Jennifer Lawrence, who's great. And she has this, you know, plan to make this house. She's sort of redesigned or redecorated this house, and it's beautiful. And they're excited for the rest of their life. And then these people start coming, and they're the first two are played by Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer, are fans of Javier Bardem, although we don't quite realize that quite at first. At first, it seems like they've just kind of stumbled in. And
they thought it was a B&B or something.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, it's not. I don't know where we're going to stay.
And so for, I don't know, the first, what, half of the movie, it's maybe not that long, but the first third of the movie, at least, is a fairly interesting drama about a couple who have different ideas of how they're going to deal with these strangers who suddenly popped into their lives.
And kind of a drama, just to interject a little bit, they're kind of a drama of manners. Like,
yes.
The people are overstepping a little, you know?
Yes.
Here and there.
And more and more as the movie goes on. And so, I don't know, I guess about a halfway through the movie, I realized that what we're really watching is a nightmare. It's the sort of nightmare you might have that, you know, is sort of realistic, but yet, you know, the nightmare when you just can't get out of this place that you're in. And so more and more people start coming and people start doing wilder and wilder things. There's murder, there's mayhem. And by the last third of the movie, it's just absolute chaos. And it's one of those movies that I would have to be very careful about, like, who I'm not going to recommend this movie to my mom or anything. I mean, I found it really compelling and I'm thoroughly glad I saw it. Well, let me stop there. What did you think?
I had a big smile on my face the whole time. I had heard it was crazy, and I had seen the trailer, and the trailer does show that it's crazy, but it doesn't show how crazy.
No, it is. It is a crazy movie.
But it's fun to think of it as a nightmare, because whose nightmare is it?
Oh, don't you think it's Jennifer Lawrence's nightmare? I just sort of assumed that. Is there a different way of...
Well, I think so, but it's so metaphorical that I feel or allegorical that it's like the artist has these fans who come and he is sort of neglecting her. What is she? She's sort of like a muse, but in some ways she's not even a muse. She's almost like the idea, the personification of his art or something, you know, that she's, it's more than simply something that inspired him. It's like the kernel of the idea or something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yet these people are coming in and they just want to rip the house that she made apart. You know, she built this, she restored this place and she's warned them about the sink not being braced and they sit on it anyway. And she feels the walls. Speaking of the tactile nature of the way Kristen Stewart felt the things in Personal Shopper, Jennifer Lawrence feels the walls and she hates to see when people have left the kitchen a mess. And, you know, it's, I don't know. Another thing is, I watched it a second time and I didn't pick this up, but the movie begins at the same place that it ends, you know, with the...
Oh, yes, yes.
I remember that part, but what I didn't remember is the woman we see at the very beginning and the woman we see again at the very end, as it seems to be in this cycle, neither of those is Jennifer Lawrence and neither of those is the same person. As if this cycle happens over and over with different people, whatever she represents, right?
Yeah.
So,
It's very clearly an allegory for the creative process.
Yeah,
and in that sense, you can see it as an allegory of Aronofsky talking about, you know, how he works and kind of what a monster he is, and I think he's responding to sort of rumors, or not so much rumors, but actual stories of how he works and how difficult he can be. But no, I think the movie's sort of really intriguing as a kind of a confession of what it means to create and what you might do to make sure that you can create. And I found that compelling too.
Yeah, because it's also about the commercialization of that process, or that the popularity and how that. So it feels a little defensive too, even though it's kind of confession. It's like, you know, you people also don't get it. You're ripping it apart. You know?
No, so, I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, I think to Aronofsky's credit, there's at least some self critique in the movie, sort of the monstrous things you might do. But no, it's also defensive at times too. Of, oh, you people don't understand my work. Or, oh my gosh, what are you doing with my work?
Yeah.
And so, but yet, I mean, what I should say though, is that for me, the most interesting character in the movie is Jennifer Lawrence. I think it's a brilliant piece of acting in what is a very difficult role, especially in the last third of the movie. And she's always compelling. It doesn't feel like, except for there's a couple times at the very end of the movie where she has to sort of, shriek in ways that just don't feel true to me. But boy, the rest of the movie is, it doesn't, she, every note she hits is right. And I really just liked watching her and sort of watching her try to deal with this nightmare. I found that very compelling.
Yeah. And it's all centered on her, because it's one thing I like about it is, if you're going to be crazy, go all out. I mean, go all out, silly as you want to be, but it's done progressively and carefully, so that it's yep. always from her point of view.
Yep.
Like we almost never see Javier Bardem when he's very far from her. We never see almost anything far from her, because she, when he's greeting, you know, people, it's at a distance, and he turns and looks at her, and we feel sort of left out of that process because we're sort of attached to her throughout. And so we hear things from her perspective. We see what she sees. And so, yeah, I think we're definitely supposed to side with her, and she is awesome. Jennifer Lawrence. She's really good there.
Yeah. And it's, I think pretty much every shot in the movie is either a shot of her, mostly in close up, or a point of view shot from her. I think pretty much every shot in the movie is one of those two things. And so it really does sort of put you in her place and her viewpoint. And I think the movie is compelling for that.
Yeah. It's fun.
So it is fun. Yeah. If you're not, you know, especially if you're willing to sort of go along for a crazy ride, it is a good time.
Now, we were talking about what would make a perfect pairing with this, you know, double features. And you brought up Paddington 2, and I thought, really, J. Robert, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I wouldn't take the kids to see Mother, but I do have to say that of the two movies I saw in January, Paddington 2 and Mother were two of my favorites. Paddington 2, I didn't see the first one. I don't know if you have it, Rob, but it's I think it got pretty good reviews, but the sequel has gotten great reviews, and I said, well, it's playing here at Hyde Park, I'll go see it, and the reviews are right. It's delightful. I don't need to go into the story. It's a very standard children's kind of story. In this case, Bear needs to find family. And to be honest, the bear is not by any means the most interesting part of the movie. What really carries the movie are three fantastic actors, Sally Hawkins, Brendan Gleeson, and especially Hugh Grant as the villain. Hugh Grant is just fantastic. If he were nominated for an acting award, I would be more than happy about that. Sally Hawkins is great too, and so is Brendan Gleeson. But these three British actors are pretty much in every scene. At least one of them is, and they're fantastic, and they carry the film. You talked about having sort of a big smile on your face for Mother. I had a big smile on my face pretty much the entire time of Paddington 2. And it's not just a kids movie, although certainly kids will enjoy it. It's very family friendly. But I thought it was pretty much perfectly done for what it's trying to do. And the fact that it has such good acting talent makes a huge, huge difference. So, yes, I recommend that if you're not in the mood for crazy, but are in the mood for something fun. I feel like I'm back on the old Siskel and Ebert. I'm about to give you a thumbs up. But no, Paddington 2 is surprisingly good. I recommend it without hesitation.
This was nowhere on my radar, but it has been so praised that I'm really curious about it myself.
Yeah. No, and if you end up seeing it with your family, I'll be curious both what you think and what they think. But I'd be pretty confident there will be you will consider it an hour and a half well spent.
All right. Good.
Have you seen anything particularly good recently? Anything that stands out?
Boy, have I. I don't think I have. I need to get to the movies.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. Well, you'll have to see Black Panther, because that's worth your time too. We'll have to talk about that at some point.
Yeah, let's do that.